Good evening and welcome to Slam the Gavel, the show that tells it all regarding family court issues. I'm your host, Marianne Petrie, and today we are going to talk with William J. McGee. He is the author of the novel Half the Child. He is an investigative journalist and columnist, as well as the former editor of Consumer Reports Travel Letter. He also is a consumer advocate for airline passengers, testifying in Congress and before the government agencies on airline safety, passenger rights, and economic issues. McGee taught creative writing for 10 years, both fiction and creative nonfiction. He also is the author of Attention All Passengers, a nonfiction expose of the airline industry published by HarperCollins. Previously, he spent 7 years in airline operations management and served in the U.S. Air Force Auxiliary. McGee graduated from Columbia University with an MFA degree in fiction. He lives in Connecticut and has one son. Half the Child was a semi-finalist in both the James Jones First Novel Competition and the William Faulkner Creative Writing Competition, and was an honorable mention in the New England Book Competition. The novel takes place over 4 consecutive summers in the lives of Michael Mullen and his son, Ben. And I'm going to let Mr. McGee explain more of that to you, but he has had also excellent reviews. And one review is from Tom DeHaven, author of It's Superman and the Derby Dugan Trilogy. He writes, "This is the real thing, a fine, smart novel with the sharp ringing sound of truth. I loved everything about it. How compelling, utterly immersive the story is, and how confident the storytelling, that it's an irresistible page turner, but at the same time, it's thoughtful and precise and wise, occasionally wise guy, in its observations about how we live now and get on or don't get on with the people in our lives. And it may just be the best novel I've read about a father's love." So, Bill, what made you want to write a novel about custody, abduction, and parental alienation?
Well, thanks very much for having me on, Marianne. And yes, I am a dad, and I have to say I wear a lot of different hats. I'm a journalist and a novelist and a teacher and many things, but nothing's more important to me than being a dad. I have one son. He's 26, and he's the love of my life. He's a great, great young man. So I've, I do have some experience with these issues, but it was something that I wanted to write about as fiction, and so I created this fictional world and these fictional characters to express the pain and the frustration that parents have when they go into this custody court system and how awful it can be and how it chews everyone up. And of course, the pain the children feel too when they don't have both parents in their lives. And so it was a work in progress for many years. I have to make that clear. I started Half the Child many, many years ago, and I sort of worked on it, put it aside, worked on other things, wrote other things, came back to it. Took a long time for me to sort of process. When I teach creative writing, I always talk about the fact that writers make a lot of decisions when they're working on any project. And it took me a long time to sort of figure out the best way to tell the story. I finally decided that was telling it in first person I rather than third person he, from the perspective of the narrator, the young father, Michael Mullen, who describes 4 summers in the lives of himself and his young son, Ben.
That was an excellent story. I encourage everyone to grab that book and read it. It's very moving. And how did it, you talk about life happening and, this almost makes you become an advocate, and like advocacy chooses you. And as far as writing this book, it was just very difficult even to get it published. You had issues getting it published.
Yeah, I love that line that you came up with, advocacy chooses you, because I think that's really, really appropriate in my case. And in more ways than one. In my career, I started out working in the airlines, and then I became a journalist writing about the airlines. And then I wound up at Consumer Reports, which is sort of unlike every other magazine in the country. It's the world's largest nonprofit consumer organization. So there's no advertising, there's no bias from the companies that we write about. And I became their sort of airline and travel expert. And then that led to the next step, which was becoming an advocate for consumers. And at first I didn't want that role, to be honest with you, because as a journalist, I'd always been, you know, told over and over again, you need to be unbiased. And then finally I embraced it. We call it advocacy journalism. And the bias that I embrace is bias on behalf of consumers. Mm-hmm. And so I'm the one who, goes to Congress very often and fights on behalf of consumers. So it took me a while to get used to that role of being an advocate for airline passengers. And then lo and behold, you know, Half the Child was published. And suddenly I found myself in the last 2 years embracing another advocacy role, and that's advocacy on behalf of parents, sometimes fathers, but not always fathers, who go through this, and the children that go through parental alienation and long and ugly custody battles and even abduction. All of those issues are addressed in Half the Child. And I don't want to give too much away, of course. I want people to read the novel and enjoy it and be surprised by it. But, you know, it is clear that it addresses not only custody issues, but also custodial abduction. And it's sort of, the question is posed of whether or not Michael and Ben will remain in each other's lives, or if they'll be separated. And so that's really what the novel is about, without saying much more than that. And as far as the publishing issues that you raised, it's a great question, because, I have to tell you, I do have a track record as an author for many years. And you mentioned my book, Attention All Passengers. That's a nonfiction book. That's not a novel. And that's an expose, really, about the airline industry and about airline safety. And, it was published, as they say, traditionally. That's the term that's used in the industry. I had an agent who, got me a great contract, and it was published by HarperCollins, one of the world's largest publishing companies. And they took care of everything and sent me on my way and put me on a media tour. And, Attention All Passengers was a modest success in that way. And so when I finished Half the Child, I had a new agent, but, very, very good, smart agent at a large literary agency. And when he started sending it out, I was pretty confident that pretty soon we'd find a place for it to get published. And, I spoke about this last year at the Parental Alienation Support Group conference in Philadelphia in 2019. And I sort of, explained this journey that we started getting rejections, which, that's par for the course, right? There's always get rejections when they send stuff out. I shouldn't say always, but most do. Most of us do. A couple of lucky ones, maybe not. But we started getting these rejections, but they were very odd rejections. It wasn't about the work itself. In fact, the work itself, most of the editors were very full of praise for it, which was great. But they said they wouldn't publish it. And so what happened was it soon became apparent that this was about gender, which, was really disturbing to me, because I think Marianne, and I know that when you go online and when you're in some of the social media groups, when you're discussing custody and abduction and these issues, there are quite a few people that have obvious problems on both sides of the aisle with gender. There are those that are bashing mothers all the time, and those that are bashing fathers all the time. And there are those that hate women and those that hate men. And I really try and distance myself from that. That's not something I have any desire to get involved with. In this novel, it's about a father who is, his rights and his son's rights are abused by the courts. And the fictional mother in this case does some awful things, including abducting the child, but she's really not, reprimanded for it. I could have easily told a similar story from the perspective of a mother. And I have women in my life, some very close to me who I love very much, who have also been abused by family courts. So this is not a gender issue. But yet the big publishing companies that were turning down this book did look at it that way. And they were saying things like, well, you know, it's one even said that, you know, she cried when she read it, and I thought, well, this is great. She's going to want to publish it. She wouldn't be able to because the women buy books, and only women read books, and also women don't want to read about fathers. To put it simply, I think they're very, very wrong. Not only do men buy books and read books, but the irony for this is I wound up self-publishing Half the Child, and so it's available through Barnes & Noble online and through Amazon, which published it, and through other booksellers and some independent bookstores. And you can buy it in print or you can buy it in Kindle. And I'm very excited. The audiobook is coming out soon. But what I have found is that the reviews from strangers that are coming in on Amazon and other places, and this is public, anyone who does see it. If you look up Half the Child on Amazon, you'll see that it has very favorable reviews. And I don't say that to be self-serving, but the point I'm making is the best I can tell from the names of those that are reviewing it, they're overwhelmingly women, like about 80% or more are women. So, you know, those editors are wrong. I don't know how else to say it. Women obviously love reading about a loving, caring, devoted father who puts his son first. To the point where I know you may think I'm kidding around, but I get through my sort of public website, halfthechild.com, I've gotten many compliments from Michael from women and even one marriage proposal from a woman from Michael. I had to explain to her, of course, that he's fictional and he doesn't exist. But
Nice.
You know, yeah. So, you know, I had to break it to her very gently. She said, you know, I would marry Michael in a moment, in a minute. And I said, well, he doesn't, you know, he lives in my head, but, you know, thank you. I'll pass that on to him. you know, this issue of gender, it comes up all the time. You know, it comes up from all sides. It comes from women. It comes from men. It comes, you know, and in fact, I address that in the novel too. At one point, Michael is, these events have a tremendously negative effect on his life. It affects everything. And at one point, you know, he's talking to someone and he talks about this and the person says to him, you know, you're going to have to make a decision on how you're going to live the rest of your life. Are you going to be one of those bitter guys sitting in a bar, you know, complaining about your ex-wife? The same could be said about a bitter woman, you know, complaining about her ex-husband. Or are you going to move on with your life when all this is over, you know? And that's sort of a fork in the road that I think those that go through these ugly battles have to make those decisions.
You're right.
And, you know, and when you get mired in the gender stuff, I just have no time for it. I have to tell you, when Half the Child first came out, I joined, you know, every social media page there was having to do with parents in custody and all of this stuff, and without really knowing who was running them. And after a while, I actually unjoined several of them because I saw so much hatred on both sides. I saw women that absolutely hated men and couldn't be reasonable with them. And I saw men who absolutely hated women and using the worst foul language you could imagine. And I said, well, I'm out of here. You know, this is not for me, you know. And the point should be made that in Michael's fictional world, he undergoes this awful experience, the worst experience of his life that very nearly kills him. And, you know, and the question is whether or not he and his son will be in each other's lives. Michael is lucky or privileged, I should say, in that he has a pretty good support system, as tough a thing as things get for him. And it's really, for the most part, women around him who pick him up, his mother, his sister, his female friends, you know, they're there for him when he needs the most. So, you know, again, I can't say it in strong enough terms. I just reject all the gender war that goes on about this. What we're talking about in most cases are people who have mental issues. They have issues with, you know, narcissism, narcissistic personality disorders. That's not, you know, that's not related to only one gender. Both men and women can have that. And, you know, we can even see public figures that clearly have it. But, you know, when you're that type of a narcissist, a textbook narcissist, your only interests are your own. Even your children aren't, you know, their interests don't come first. And so that's what Michael's fighting. He's not fighting a woman. He's fighting someone with, you know, a severe disability.
I agree. And I just wish people would pull together and work together to fix a situation instead of saying gender this, gender that. Who cares? Yeah. Let's all pull together and try to fix this.
Right. And I'm sure you see it too, Maryam, when you go online and when you go on some of the social media sites related to this. I've tried to reason with some people who have been, bashing on both sides, and sometimes you can't reason. You know, sometimes you can, but very often you can't, because people sort of have their own minds made up and their own agendas. And there's no question that it's just, you know, it's misogyny in some cases. People that hate men, and the flip side of misogyny, a word that you don't hear as often, misandry, people, you know, that, misogyny meaning hating women, and misandry meaning hating men. I meant men hating women and women hating men. But neither of those things help the children. And, you know, it sounds kind of corny when you say it, but this is all about the kids, first and foremost. That's how I look at it. That's how Michael in this novel looks at it. Mm-hmm. You know, his feeling is, if we work things out so Ben is happy, then everything else falls into place and we take it from there. But if you're going to abduct a child and take him, you know, overseas away from one parent, a good, fit, loving parent, that's unacceptable. And, in far too many cases, we all understand, by the way, that there are exceptions. We understand that there are abusive, violent, you know, parents, that there are parents that are, you know, have substance abuse problems and can't be around children. We understand that. But those are the minority. That's not the rule. And so, you know, we're not talking about a father who shouldn't be a father. We're talking about a guy whose whole life is his son. The most important thing in his life, that's all he wants, is to be a good father. And the court system is not allowing him. And, you know, and Ben is the one that's being hurt. The child's being hurt because he loves his daddy so much and he misses his daddy.
Right. And I think the court system perpetuates the parental alienation as well. They encourage it. They write orders to keep it going. Orders such as no contact orders.
Right.
And I really wish this would all just stop. And I think your writing of your book and my book, which is Dismantling Family Court Corruption, Why right. Taking the Kids Was Not Enough. Between more of these stories that are told, parents will start to see what's going on. And it helps, like with your book, how this affected the father and the stress it puts a parent under is what a lot of people don't understand when you go through the family court system.
Right, right. And you know, you make a great point. And by the way, I just started your book, Maryam, and I'm loving it. So I can't wait to get back to it. I was happy we swapped books recently so we can share each other's work with each other. But in Half the Child, if I could, I'd like to talk a little bit about Michael Mullen, our fictional narrator.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, so he, when I was deciding what kind of a job to give him, I realized I couldn't get away from aviation, which I had thought I would with this book. Originally, I wrote him as a salesman, and I said, that's not going to work. And so I gave him as high stressful a job as I could. He's an air traffic controller at LaGuardia Airport in New York City, one of the toughest airports in the world to be an air traffic controller at. And Michael is very much a professional, very much one that other air traffic controllers admire. For his work ethic and how he is able to just sort of shut everything out when he goes up into the tower, even if he's having a fight with his wife or a problem, you know, with money, whatever. When he goes up in the tower, it's all about the airplanes. And what happens throughout the course of this novel, Half the Child takes place over four consecutive summers. Ben is 2.5, then 3.5, then 4.5, then 5.5. And over these four consecutive summers, as things keep getting worse and worse and worse, for the first time, the outside problems are bleeding into Michael's work. And needless to say, air traffic control is not a profession in which you can be distracted. And he starts getting distracted by the problems with his son, particularly when his son is abducted. And, the stakes couldn't be any higher. It's a life and death job. I tried to make the point that in the United States, and particularly in financial sectors, a lot of jobs are treated as life and death. You know, it's like when it involves money and, you know, Wall Street and things like that. And if the deal falls through, you know, it's not the end of the world. But in his case, he literally has a life and death job. If he makes a mistake, people can die. And so, you know, for the first time at work, he finds his performance affected. And for the first time, he's been an air traffic controller for many years, first in the military and then at LaGuardia Airport. And he's distracted and he can't get Ben out of his head. You know, he can't shut it off like he used to. And throughout the course of the novel, every aspect of Michael's life is adversely affected by this custody and abduction drama. His finances force him to have to give up his apartment, and he's virtually homeless, but he's sleeping on his brother's sofa. And, you know, he goes into tremendous debt, and then he starts having, you know, physical problems and not taking care of himself. And then he starts having emotional and mental issues. And eventually it leads to a clinical depression situation in which he, you know, becomes suicidal. I'm not giving away anything in the novel, believe me, I never would do that. But this is all very upfront that these, you know, and this is what happens, what people may not realize. For the parents who don't walk away, sometimes parents walk away and they start a new life without the child, and the child has a life without them. But for parents who say, no, I'm not walking away. And I don't mean to, you know, cast aspersions on those who, for whatever reason, don't fight that fight. There's other, you know, extenuating circumstances. But in Michael's case, he basically draws a line and says, you know, I'll die before Ben is taken from my life. And so it just negatively affects everything. He loses friendships over it, you know, his academic career, he's in graduate school studying psychology, that gets put on hold. Everything about his life, you know, his boss is calling him in and reprimanding him for the first time in his career. You know, there's a question of whether or not he's going to lose his job. Your life comes apart in these situations. And all he does is sit up at night longing, you know, to be with his son. And his son, as young as he is on the other side of the world, and he's longing to be with his daddy, you know. And this is the type of heartbreak that, you know, if you haven't been exposed to it, it's really even hard to measure, you know. And at one point, you know, speaking of abduction, I think it's an important point to make. At one point in the novel, you know, Michael refers to his son being abducted, and someone says, well, it's not really abducted, it's his mother, you know, and Michael has to explain, no, that's really abduction. I know I did the research when I was writing Half the Job. The number was, I think I'm pretty much in the ballpark. I think it's something like 94% of all abductions in the United States are by an adult who the child knows, overwhelmingly family members, okay? Sometimes parents, grandparents, what have you. And also to think that, you know, that it's not really an abduction. I'm putting really in air quotes there. No, that's very much the textbook definition of abduction, number one. And number two, to think that, well, therefore, since it's not, you know, some sort of low life, you know, pedophile in a van that, you know, stole a child, that therefore the child's going to be okay. Well, actually, statistically, that's not the case either, because even in those family abductions, very often, you know, not all the time, of course, but, you know, in far too many cases, it does, in fact, lead to violence and even death, you know, and you know, suicide pacts and parents taking the children's lives and their own, et cetera. So this idea that, you know, it's not really an abduction, you know, Michael has to fight that. And I think as an author, I've sort of had to fight it because, you know, when you say you've written a novel about abduction, I think a lot of people, their mind thinks like, oh, this is, you know, some creep that was hanging around a schoolyard and threw a child in the back of a car. And it's, oh, well, it's only the mother, you know, or it's only the father. Well, it's not only, you know, that is, you know, that is, as I said, you know, more than 9 out of 10 abductions in this country are about that. And they don't always have happy endings. Sometimes they have the most tragic of all endings, you know. And so Michael didn't bargain for any of this, you know. Like many other people, he fell in love with a woman, he got married, and they had a child. And he, you know, up until the time that she walked out with their son, he thought, you know, life was pretty good. so he was sort of blindsided by this. And, you know, as a writer, I made the decision to write this, not just in first person, I, from Michael's perspective, but I also wrote it, so fairly unusual. I wrote it in present tense. As a creative writing professor, a lot of my students over the years, you know, they just sort of rely on past tense. And I wrote it in present tense, you know, rather than say he walked into the room, he walks into the room, to give it this sense of immediacy. And, it, you know, statistically, most novels are written in past tense. But the reason I wrote it in present tense, I wanted the reader to feel the shocks as Michael was feeling them. Because perspective changes everything, you know, perspective changes everything. When you talk about something that's unraveling right now before your eyes, you're going to talk about it very differently in 6 months or a year or 10 years, you know, and you've had time to process it and you know, and go over it. I wanted everyone reading it to feel it the way Michael felt it. At times I've described this novel as sort of one long car accident in slow motion. Every time Michael thinks, you know, that things are getting a little better, they're not. Things in fact get worse progressively throughout the novel, you know. And every time he thinks, well, okay, now things are going to settle down and now the courts will take over and, you know, and things will be okay. And he's a babe in the woods, really. You know, he goes into this court system and it's like, you know, watching, you know, a butcher hack up a, you know, meat. It's just, he's just eaten up by it. And and so is Ben. And he's flabbergasted by that because he's sort of like a lot of Americans thinks, well, you know, we'll go to court and things will work out. And the court system is so dysfunctional and so corrupt that they don't work out because of it.
And that's what a lot of parents think is going to happen. They think they're going to walk into those family courtroom doors where there are no video cameras or tamper-proof mics. Yes, you have a transcriber there, but there is no justice there. It's not really a courtroom.
Right.
And the biggest shock to a lot of people is this wasn't fair. We walked out of here, we lost, we paid X amount of dollars in attorney fees, and what did we gain? We lost.
Right. Right. And, you know, there's another aspect to that too, Marianne. You raised some great points, but I think a lot of people don't realize family court doesn't have the same presumption of innocence that every other court does, right? So if you are in a public place, you're in a bar or a restaurant or something, and someone accuses you of assault, you know, you go through the court system and you produce witnesses and you produce evidence and, you know, it's determined that yes, you assaulted someone or no, you didn't, and you're found innocent or guilty. But in family court, there is no presumption of innocence and you can be accused of the worst things without any evidence having to be brought to trial. You know, it is not, I don't think that most people that haven't been through this experience or have someone close to them go through it have any idea how grossly unfair it is and the bias. Now, you know, I think particularly, you know, this year in 2020, many of us, you know, are talking a lot, and I think it's a good thing, about bias in law enforcement and based on race and other factors. And, you know, in family court, there's tremendous bias, and it's something that you can't even fight against. You can't even file, you know, an appeal against it. There are strangers that have your children's lives in their hands, and they are making decisions on how often a child is going to be with a parent that child loves. And most kids want to be with both parents if both parents, you know, are good parents, and they're forced to choose. It's cruelty of the highest order. I can't stress it enough. That's why I wanted to write a book about it. I don't think enough people understand just how cruel and unfair it is. And, you know, I'm an American like many others who basically, as critical as I am of things, and I'm very critical, and you know, I'm a consumer advocate and I criticize government actions all the time. But for the most part, I was a bit naive too. I thought, well, you know, in the end, right usually wins in a court of law because, you know, you expose everything to the truth and you lay it all out, and then reasonable people will say, okay, this is, you know, this is what's best. That doesn't happen in family court, not in any state in the union. It's state by state by state, and it's not, well, it's just a problem in one state or two states. This is all states. And it's a worldwide problem. In fact, I've come to learn that. I didn't know it when I was writing the book, but I've come to see that now. And, you know, getting to know people like you. And it's incredible how much work has to be done. You know, we're in the 21st century and we have these, you know, outdated, ineffective, terrible that, you know, they're dealing with the most precious thing of all, our children. You know, we're not, you know, if you sue someone over money, you're going to have a much better day in court over, you know, over dollars and cents than you're ever going to have over your child. I mean, think about that and how wrong that is.
Right. And I believe it was Dr. Mark Rosemann that said that when you take a child away from a parent, it will affect the next six future generations.
Right. And I heard that too. It blew me away. Yeah.
I just can't believe that we're doing this to our future, which is so important.
Yeah. Well, and you know, that ties back sort of to the title, Half the Child. Anyone that's interested in, you know, learning more about the book can go to the website. It's very simple. It's just halfthechild.com. No punctuation or anything. Halfthechild.com. And the title actually comes from a very old and famous story, a biblical story. And you know, that's King Solomon, you know, and the legend of King Solomon, who had two mothers come before him fighting over a child, you know, maybe the first custody battle ever recorded, you know, and one of them was lying. One of them had rolled over in her sleep and suffocated her baby by accident. And so she claimed the other baby as his own, and both mothers came into court fighting over this baby. And King Solomon listened to both of them. And then he called upon a soldier to draw his sword. And he said, okay, I'll settle this. I'll cut the child in half. And the woman who was not the mother said, fine. And the woman who was the mother and cared about the child said, no, you know, let her have it. And he, being the wisest king, you know, knew that that was in fact the real mother and awarded the child to her. It's a story that, even though I've told it and read it dozens of times, it still gives me tingles and sort of a chill up my spine. You know, it's so moving. And that's at the center of Half the Child, you know. And that's really what we're doing to children every day. We're slicing them up. We may not be using swords. We're slicing them up in court. And even in cases where, you know, one of the greatest misnomers of all time, joint custody. Again, I'm doing air quotes because there ain't nothing joint about joint custody, okay? Even in those cases where, you know, it's such a feel-good term. It's, oh, joint custody, isn't that wonderful? Both parents. The child gets to be with both. You know, a standard agreement and one that's addressed in this book is what Michael refers to as a seventh of a child, where you're with the child every other weekend for 2 days. So 2 out of 14 days, right? So that ratio is 12 days to 2 or 6 to 1, right? So it's not even half the child. It's a seventh of a child in many cases, you know, or less, depending on, you know, the agreements. Some are better. I understand that. I mean, there may be people saying, no, I saw my child every other day or something. And great, more power to those parents that work out those agreements. But in contentious agreements, you know, it can be awful and they can be separated by many miles and et cetera. You know, I have a friend who, when they got divorced, they purposely, this is post-divorce, mind you, they bought houses right next to each other for their child's sake so that the kid could just, you know, go back and forth, no pickups, no drop-offs. I mean, it was it just was so wonderful and moving and loving. And, you know, they didn't want to be married. I mean, I'm not, you know, sugarcoating it, but they, you know, they put their kids' needs first, and they both wound up being with other partners, but they, you know, they said, we're going to do this for the kid. Imagine if every set of parents did something along those lines, maybe not literally next door. Some people wouldn't want to do that, but close enough, right? You know, that you can make it work.
And I have seen it done with my own eyes. I've seen it done. That two exes, you know, they got together for their daughter's graduation, and right. Even the new husband, who is, they've been married quite a while, but you know, he was talking to the ex-husband. I mean, friendship-wise, it can be done if you've got normal, emotionally healthy individuals that can co-parent on that level.
Right, and you know. I mean, look, divorce is awful, but it's also, you know, it's very common, as we all know. I believe the statistics are still, it's more than 50% of all American marriages. So, you know, that's one thing. I mean, you know, we're all adults. We make our own choices, and sometimes they don't work out. But you have to step back and say, look, if there's no kids, then fine. Then go fight over the house or the car or whatever it is. Good luck and, you know, move on. But if there's a kid involved, then everything has changed as far as I'm concerned. From my perspective, it's like, well, now everything has changed. It's not about you. It's not about your partner. It's not about your career. It's not about your money, your house, or anything else. It's about that child first. And I feel like I'm on a soapbox saying this, but to me, it's just the most basic, decent thing to say. It's not like I'm out there, you know, promoting something that's so radical. It's like you had a kid, everything changes, and the kid has to come first. Put his or her needs first, and then you figure out the rest of it. But, you know, far too many people are selfish, and they're worried about whatever they're worried about, their love life or their career or their, you know, their bank account or whatever it is, and the kid comes second or third or fourth or fifth, you know.
Right.
And it's just not acceptable. And you would hope that the courts would recognize that and say, well, wait a minute, you know, which parent cares more, you know? And unfortunately, you know, we're really short of King Solomon's these days. You know, we are really short of King Solomon. I wish every court had a King Solomon, without the sword, of course. But, you know, we just don't. We don't have it.
Well, you know, what have you learned from children and parents that have been affected by parental alienation since your publication of your book, Half the Child? Has anyone approached you?
Yeah, quite a few people, in fact. You know, as I said, when I made the decision to self-publish, I didn't realize, I guess I was spoiled with my first book. As I mentioned, you know, it was published by HarperCollins, and there was a whole team at, you know, this big publishing house that took care of everything, and the, you know, the artwork and the editing and the, you know, the promotion and the publicity and everything. And that was great. And I went off to CNN and Fox News and everything, and they helped me every step of the way, and NPR. But with self-publishing, I had to really do a crash course in all of those things, because, you know, I'm basically a writer. I'm not a publisher. I'm not an editor. And I had to learn all those things, you know. But I didn't have a lot of money, but I invested money of my own into making the book as good as it can be. And one was hiring a great artist to do the cover, Eric Hofstin, which I'm biased, but I love the cover of Half the Child, and a great copy editor and photographer and all the rest of it, and some of the help with publicity. And so I went out there and started promoting the book. And like I said, one of the things I did was, you know, have a big social media presence, so that you can find Half the Child on, you know, on Amazon, excuse me, on Facebook and on Twitter and on Instagram and LinkedIn. And I started talking to people. And then I started, you know, hearing about parental alienation. And so when I spoke last year, I mentioned it earlier, I spoke, I think probably the world's largest organization devoted to parental alienation, PASG, the Parental Alienation Support Group. And they had their conference last year in the state that you're in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania. And I was invited to speak. And I spoke with Ginger Gentile, who is a filmmaker who made a terrific documentary, Erasing Family. So they wanted to have two artists, you know, get up and speak, because there was no shortage of, you know, attorneys and mental health professionals who were all great, but they wanted to close, you know, the conference with having two people who had, you know, brought art to this painful subject. And Ginger made a great film, and so she spoke for about a half hour, and I spoke for about a half hour. And when I got up, I have to tell you, Marianne, the first thing I did was make a confession, and that was, I said, I want you to know that I spent more than a decade writing this novel that at its heart is about parental alienation. And I didn't know until I had finished it that that's what it was about. I had never heard the term. Okay? And I'm not ashamed to admit that, you know. Mm-hmm. And I, when I spoke at the conference, I referenced my father, who, you know, has long since passed away, but who was a World War II veteran. And was in some of the worst combat in World War II in Anzio and elsewhere, and was wounded. And there's no question to his family that he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, but he didn't know it. He I don't think he ever heard the term his whole life, you know, and he suffered with it for decades, for 50 or 60 years. And understandably so, based on what he went through, it was horrific. But things don't always have a name, but they exist. Okay, that was the moral of the story for me. If I had said to my father on his deathbed, you know that you've had PTSD since 1944, he would have said, PTS what? You know, And so I was writing about parental alienation without ever having heard the term. I knew both words separately. I'd never heard anybody say parental alienation. If I did, it didn't register with me. And I wrote this book. And if you get into a version and you do a word search, you'll find the term is only used once. Because again, remember, this is from Michael's perspective. He doesn't know what it is either, okay? And so at one point, a therapist says something about parental alienation to him. And it just goes over his head. He doesn't even ask about it. So whatever you call something, the condition exists, even if you don't know it has a name. And so that's been my journey. With my first book, I spent so much work researching about aviation safety and writing this expose and talking to experts all over the world. And I flew everywhere from India to Latin America to everywhere to write it and to research it. And then I went out, not saying, well, I'm an expert, but I've spoken to experts and now I'm ready to go on NPR for an hour on Fresh Air and talk about it. In this case, I spent all these years writing Half the Child. And then I went out and I started learning more than I was, than I was able to share in some cases, because I started meeting other, parents who had experienced this. I started meeting grown children who had been victims of parental alienation and even abduction when they were, 30, 40 years ago. It was amazing. It has been amazing, continues to be amazing, and I meet people all the time and I talk to people like yourself and, I just keep learning and learning. And it just strikes me that, I'm not trying to be self-serving, but I go back to those editors who said there was no market for this book. So many people have been affected by this. And it's not just parent and child. It's not just mother, father, child. It's everybody gets affected by these issues, by parental alienation and visitation and custody and abduction. It's grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins and friends and other siblings and new spouses and new boyfriends and girlfriends. And it's a whole circle. In Ben's world, it's not just his mother and his father that are affected by Ben's disappearance. It's more than a dozen close people, to him.
And even pets. I mean, even the
yes,
kids.
Yes, absolutely. Right.
I know when my boys were gone, the dog moped around for 3 months. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
Pets are people too.
No question. That's a great point. I wish I had added a pet in Ben's world, but there is an awful lot of love. So many people love Ben in this novel, and they miss him terribly. It's not just Michael. It's not just his father whose life is destroyed by this. But to me, that's about as selfish as you can get to hurt a child, an innocent child. It's not to say that I think, all's fair with adults, but I just sort of have a different code for adults. We have more resources. We're able to protect ourselves and defend ourselves a little more. Children are defenseless for the most part, and they go where they're told to go. They don't have a choice to say, well, I'm walking out or I'm going somewhere else, Ben is so young that when he's abducted, he can't even reach out to his father. He just wonders why his father isn't calling like he calls every other day. And where are you, daddy? And so what happens? He becomes angry because his daddy stopped talking to him, right? He has no idea that his daddy doesn't even know what country he's in, right? It's cruelty of the highest order. It really is, because to do that to a little child,
Yeah, they don't understand. They have no concept of what's being told to them. I know my father said, oh, these kids know what's going on. They know what's really happening here. Mm-hmm. And a lot of other people had said that to me, but I've always just, zipped it, never said anything.
Right.
And part of me regrets that as well, because I should have been maybe honest with them instead of sugarcoating like I was told to do.
Right. Well, Marianne, you raise a great point, and that is, I think 99% of people that go into these situations, they have no guidebook, they have no rules, right? I'm someone who usually when I'm given a task, I do research. You know, I'm a journalist and I research things, and I, you know, and I go online and I say, what do I need to learn about this new subject? Whatever it is, you know. Most people go into these, you know, first of all, who goes into a relationship or a marriage or parenthood thinking, well, this is all going to blow up and turn awful, right? You don't, most of us don't do that. We have the highest of hopes. So you're not prepared for this. And when it's not a fair fight, really, when you're fighting someone who's a narcissist, they're always five steps ahead. They're very manipulative. They've planned this, you know, in many cases, they clear out the bank accounts. They make secret plans to move away. They do all kinds of things that you're not even remotely thinking of. You're thinking like, oh, you know, got a pretty good relationship. And they're already two steps away from leaving with a child in many cases, you know. So nobody goes into this, with a handbook. I can tell you a real quick story, and that is that I've been hearing from readers, strangers who have, you know, bought the book online, and I had a reader reach out to me through the website, halfthechild.com. And she said she didn't like the book for the most part. She was critical. And I said, I don't think she expected me to respond to her. A lot of people, you know, like they go online and they get very rude at times or very, you know, strong opinions. And then they think they're just talking and no one's listening. But I responded and I said, please tell me. And so she started talking to me and she said, well, I thought that, you know, Michael made a lot of really bad decisions in this novel. I said, and that bothered you, that kept you from enjoying it. And she said, yes, he did a lot of stupid things. And I said, do you mind if I ask you what you do for a living? This is all by email. And she said, well, I'm a paralegal. And I said, uh-huh, so you know about the law. She goes, yeah, and she had like page numbers. She said, on page 82, he did this, and on page 153, he did this. Those were mistakes. He shouldn't have done that. He should have had his lawyer do such and such. And I said, well, you know, I mean, first of all, you can never get someone who doesn't like something to like it. But I said, I want you to understand that, you know, I'm responding to your criticism by saying that's the point. That's why I wrote it the way I wrote it. There isn't much of a novel to be written if you have a lawyer involved in a custody battle, for the most part, who knows all about these things and knows exactly what to do. There's very little dramatic tension there. Michael's an air traffic controller. You know, I mean, he could have been, you know, someone who works in a grocery store. He could have been a computer geek. He could have been a firefighter. He could have been any one of a million things, a nurse. He's an air traffic controller. He has no experience with this. And that is what the court system in this country does. It chews people up and it works off of their naivete. And look, we haven't even mentioned it, but what is it all about? It's about money. This is an industry like so many other things in America. And this is big, big bucks. We're talking in the billions. I've even heard the T word used for the trillions in terms of all of it. The court fees, the lawyers, the judges, the child support payments, all the rest of it, all of this. It's an industry. The forensic psychologists and the forensic accountants. And Michael is yet another victim being thrown into this, you know, this sawmill. And so is Ben. And so, you know, I welcome all readers. And if somebody doesn't like the book, great, I'll talk about it with you. I'm happy to talk about it. No, but I was trying to make the point with this woman that, you know, the whole idea is that I wanted to write about someone who doesn't know how the system works. Because that to me is the real tragedy. If Michael knew how it worked, it wouldn't have gone as awfully as it does, you know.
Right, because then your main character would know which lawyer to pick out who was best friends with the judge.
Right, exactly.
So then your case would have gone much smoother.
Exactly, and that is addressed too. At one point, he realizes that, you know, Ben's mother has an attorney who seems to be buddy-buddy with everyone in the court, and his attorney is a stranger, you know. And he just gets this sinking feeling inside, like, uh-oh, you know, this is bad, you know. And all too often, you're right. I mean, that's what goes on. So you're really not paying for someone's law expertise. You're paying for them to have connections, you know, and be on a first-name basis with the judge's assistant and things like that. Again, we're talking about kids here. This is just so awful. I mean, it'd be bad enough if we were talking about, you know, civil court and fighting over lawsuits and things, you know, for money. But we're talking about kids' lives.
Right.
It's disgraceful. It's really disgraceful. I can't put it in strong enough terms.
No, you can't. And their suffering can't be fixed. I mean, maybe it can be fixed over time, but there's no guarantee it can be fixed.
No, and you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about some of the adults that I've gotten in touch with since the book has come out, and talked to, and even done a few podcasts with, and some of them are adults who were victims as children, mm-hmm. and they're still dealing with these issues years later, decades later.
And that's not right to do to a little kid that has no idea what's going on.
You raise a great point, because I've gotten to know, just since the book has come out, and I've even done some podcasts and interviews with adults who were the children who were victims of parental alienation and abduction, in some cases, years and even decades ago. And, you know, we were talking before about how abduction is abduction, even when it's a family member. And in many cases, you know, we're talking about adults in their 30s, 40s, 50s, older, who are walking around and haven't spoken to their biological parents in decades. In some cases, they've been told lies about that parent, that the parent abandoned them when they didn't, or the parent was abusive when they weren't. You know, it's heartbreaking. I've heard some happy stories about, you know, reunions. But even the happy stories are very bittersweet, because all you can do is think, what about all those lost years, you know, all those lost decades where you weren't there for, you know, graduations and weddings, but not just the small things, just the everyday stuff, you know, you're not in someone's life. It's heartbreaking, you know, and until you really start to understand parental alienation, I know there's controversy about it in some psychological circles and some legal circles. I reject that, as so many others do. This is a real thing. Unless you have experienced it, there's no way you could possibly say parental alienation is not real. That's political, as far as I'm concerned. Those who have some sort of agenda to say that it doesn't exist. I mean, all I can say to that is, you know, that's bull. I'm sorry. You know, when you see children who are poisoned, you know, mentally, against a good, loving parent, you know, that's the worst thing you can do. And so, you know, like I say, even the happy endings are sort of sad at the same time. And not every story has a happy ending. And it's heartbreaking.
Yes, it is. You know, with this book that you've written, would you like to see it into like a movie series or TV series, movie? Do you see that in the future?
Yeah, I would love that. I'm out there trying to, you know, trying to reach out and trying to talk to a producer about it. I think, you know, it's very hard when you're the author of something to have any perspective, but I have a lot of friends who are writers, and several of them have said to me, and other folks too who aren't writers have said, just had a friend the other day who said to me, you know, she sees it as a movie. She can see these characters on the screen, you know. And I think so too. You know, due to COVID, the movie business is taking a hit, but TV is thriving. Everyone's home binge watching their favorite shows. And, you know, the production of TV series continues to, you know, to be stronger than ever in some cases. And so I would love to see that. And I think, you know, not just for, you know, the obvious personal reasons, but also, you know, that could bring more people to come back and read the book that don't know about it now. You know, I'm doing the best I can, and I'm so grateful to you, Marianne, for, you know, for helping me talk about Half the Job. But to me, it's just such an important message. You know, this has been a labor of love writing it and promoting it, and I just, you know, I'll continue to do it. And it's just, I want people to hear about this, because I, you know, the best comments I get, very often personal, they're not publicly posted, but I get an email or a text or something where somebody says, wow, I had no idea. I didn't know this went on. Or, oh, it made me rethink what happened with my sister, my brother, my cousin, whatever, you know. Oh, I didn't realize that, you know. And as you know, it happens every day. And the worst part is the court system does nothing to prevent it in many cases.
And people don't understand it unless it happens to them. You know, right. Some people you talk to, they get it, right. even though they've never been through it. And some people think, well, you know, maybe that's a kid thing that they're talking to you like that.
Right.
Or they don't understand that alienation concept until it really happens to you.
Right.
And I remember back in about 6 years ago, I wrote to my attorney explaining parental alienation. And his response was, you know, he really could care less. You know, it's really.
Right.
That's kind of, right. What the return, probably $150 letter I had to pay for to get back.
Right, of course. Of course. And then pay for him to read it by the hour. You know, but Michael undergoes that throughout the novel. There's, you know, a series of encounters that he has, people at work, old friends, things like that, who just don't get it, you know. And he even speaks to the reader about that at one point. He says, many people just don't get it, and they never will. And what happens is Michael finds that his priorities have shifted, and he no longer has room in his life for those people. If you're not going to get it, he really doesn't want to be around you. And other people who he was not that close to prior to this event, now he is closer to. So interesting things like that happen. You know, he refers to it as like new alliances and losing old alliances, you know. And at one point he goes with an old friend from high school and they go to play basketball or something. And, you know, he's explaining what's going on. And the guy just, you know, says to him very nonchalantly, well, what's the big deal? You'll see your kid next Christmas, you know, 6 months from now. What are you so upset about? You know, you'll see him at Christmas and you'll have a good time, you know. And Michael says to us, the readers, he says, I can't even respond to that. There's no words that would, you know. So he just says, this is the last time I'm going to see this guy. You know, I don't want him in my life. I don't have the energy to try and explain it to him if he doesn't get it, you know.
Right, right. I mean, I've had, you know, close friends that I thought were friends. Right. I like to have friends for life.
Right,
but, me too. You know, I was shocked at a response I had gotten out of this close friend. I don't speak to them anymore.
Right.
It's like you've already been verbally abused in the court system, and now we don't need this from you either.
Right, right. You say that your child's been abducted, and, you know, people respond, oh, well, that's a nice place that they went to, you know, for the abduction. So, you know, first places, you know. I mean, how do you respond to that? I explain it. That's what Michael is faced with here, you know. And then other people who he, you know, was not particularly close to suddenly come step forward and say, you know, in some cases, well, I went through this too, or something similar, or I know someone who did, you know. And there's a sort of community that builds, you know, quietly, you know. And, you know, it just, you're right. I mean, I think it touches so many people. It may not be you yourself that was affected by it, but you may know someone. And quite frankly, this is what we tried to tell the editors when we were trying to sell the book, is it's not just the audience for this book. It's not just, you know, parents and children that have been directly affected, but all the people in their lives, you know, who would say, hey, you got to read this book because it's very similar to what you went through, you know.
Definitely. Definitely. And I hope that you can have it turned into a film, have it looked at very closely. It's a lot. It's informative, a lot to learn from. Is there anything you would like to add before we...
Well, you've been so great, Marianne, and this has been such a great discussion. I don't think so. I would just like to, you know, remind folks that I'm always accessible. I'm always happy to talk to anyone with questions about the book, good, bad, or indifferent. That's fine. Criticisms, you know, praise, whatever. And, you know, halfthechild.com is the easiest way. I'm also on social media. All the, you know, you can find Half the Child on social media and all the sites. But, you know, if you go to halfthechild.com, you'll see there's a way to contact me. It's an email account that's dedicated to the website. I check it every day, or I try to. And, you know, I'll get back and I'll answer any questions or however I can help. So, again, I can't thank you enough. It's been great talking to you. And it's great meeting you. And I'm looking forward to finishing your book.
Thank you so much. And I would like to say Slam the Gavel is a podcast to help the public understand what really goes on in the family courtrooms that in turn perpetuate parental alienation. I'm your host, Marianne Petry, author of Dismantling Family Court Corruption. Please join us again in the future for another exciting episode. Good night.